He lost track of time, alone for once, not moving. If he was spotted by anybody within the quiet home, he wasn't disturbed. He was surprised to notice the shadow starting to lengthen, the afternoon drawing on. He left the little graveyard to start the long walk back to Jansen's. And he saw a figure standing across the road, a woman in a nun's habit, just standing, apparently watching him. He crossed the road. He couldn't see her face. She looked youngish.
"Can I help you, sister?"
"Well, I've been away."
Her voice was a soft brogue.
"I only learned of Agnes's death recently. Would you be Joshua Valiente by any chance? Your face is familiar from the news." "Oh, dear me, where are my manners? I am Sister Conception. Agnes and me, we went back a long way. In fact, we took our vows together. I knew she would become a force in the world. Always knew it, even though she could be a mouthy madam."
Joshua stayed silent. Sister Conception took a long look at Joshua's face.
"It isn't working, is it?"
"Well, if you want me to think that you aren't who you really are, no. I'd know her in the pitch dark. I can remember her walking through the dormitory every night before standing at the door and turning the light out. The click of that old Bakelite switch, held together with glue because there was never any money for rewiring. The way she made us all feel safe. Besides, she never was a good liar, or any good at an Irish accent."
"Joshua,
I think I can work it out.
Lobsang?" "Lobsang.
A stunt like this is just like him. And it was me who brought him in to see Agnes when she was dying. All my fault, probably. And now, well, here you are."
"Joshua?"
"Hello, Agnes." He threw his arms around her until she burst out laughing and pushed him away.
Chapter 26. For Agnes, it had begun with awakening. She had felt a gentle warmth and a certain sense of pink. She thought this over for an indeterminate time. The last thing she remembered was her own bed in the home, the murmuring of a priest. She said more cautiously than hopefully,
"And I am in heaven?"
"No, heaven can wait," said a male voice calmly. "We have more urgent matters to consider."
Sister Agnes whispered, although she wasn't sure how she whispered,
"And will there be a band of angels?"
"Not exactly," said the firmament. "But top marks for getting in a reference to the works of the late Jim Steinman in your first minute of revived consciousness. Now, alas, you must sleep again." And darkness returned to cover the firmament. As it faded, the firmament said, "Amazing."
What was most amazing was that all this was spoken in Tibetan, and that she understood. More time passed.
"Agnes, I have to wake you again for a little while, just for calibration."
That was when they showed Agnes her new body, pink, naked, raw, and very female.
"Who ordered those?"
"I'm sorry?"
"Look, even before my bosom headed south for the winter, I assure you it wasn't that size. Can you please tone it down a little?"
"Don't worry, all things are mutable. If you will bear with us, we will eventually be able to present you with a suite of bodies for all occasions. All prosthetic, of course. You'll certainly pass as human. Things have got a lot more sophisticated since I began my own experiments. Although quite a lot of you, technically speaking, will not be human. Incidentally, you are being attended by a number of surgeons and other medical personnel in the pay of a little-known subsidiary of the Black Corporation. They have no idea of your identity. Fun, isn't it?"
"Fun?"
Suddenly Agnes knew exactly who was doing this to her.
"Lobsang! You bastard!"
The dark rose up again, but her anger stayed. The anger she had always looked on as an ally, anger that filled her up. She clung to that heed now. Eventually the pinkness returned, and the voice of Lobsang spoke again, gently.
My apologies once more, but this is a very delicate procedure, what you might call the end game. I have been working on your revival for 3 years, and now it's nearly done. Sister Agnes, dear Agnes, you have nothing to fear. Indeed, I expect to meet you in person after breakfast tomorrow. While you wait, would you care for some music? Not more bloody John Lennon. No, no. Knowing your taste, what is your position on the works of Bonnie Tyler?
Sister Agnes woke up yet again, bewildered and smelling coffee and bacon and eggs. The scent emanated from a tray close by the bed on which she lay, evidently placed there by a young lady, bespectacled, friendly, Asiatic, perhaps Japanese.
There is no hurry, madam. Take your time. My name is Hiro. Please ask for anything you desire.
In fact, coming back to life seemed to get easier as it went along. With Hiro's help, she made her way to the bathroom of what appeared to be a bland hotel suite, took a shower, stared at her perfect teeth in the mirror, and voided her bowels of nothing very much. Hiro said,
You should find physical matters easy. We took your body through many basic processes while you were in deep sleep, training it, so to speak. Would you be so kind as to walk up and down for a while and tell me what you feel?
Sister Agnes did indeed walk around and gave her report. She tasted the coffee, which wasn't bad at all, and was surprised to find that the bacon was crisp to the point of charcoal, just as she had always liked it. And then there was a closet full of clothing, including a habit of the kind she had worn for so many years. She hesitated. As a Catholic nun, somewhat estranged from her church's orthodoxy, if she had been uncertain of her theological status before all this, she was bewildered now. But she had made her vows long ago, and she supposed they still applied, so she donned the garment. And as she dressed, she smiled, enjoying the surcease of old age pain in every joint, a feeling of liberty of movement long forgotten. She said to the Japanese girl,
I imagine I have an appointment with Lobsang himself.
Hiro laughed.
Well done. He said that you would be quick to get to the point. If you would kindly follow me.
Agnes followed the girl along a steel-walled corridor, passed through a series of doors which opened and closed with a certain automated panache, and was ushered into a room full of books and antique furnishings. It might have been Charles Darwin's study, down to the blazing fire in an antique hearth. But it was a place Agnes recognized, from Joshua's description of a similar experience. Lobsang chic, it seemed. Across the room was a swivel chair, heavily stuffed, with its back to her. She snapped,
It's fake, isn't it? The fire? Joshua told me about it. He said it wasn't randomized properly.
There was no answer from the swivel chair.
Now listen to me. I don't know whether I should be incredibly grateful or incredibly angry. But this is what Joshua asked for on your behalf, a cultured voice replied at last. Or so I inferred. I was brought to see you when you were ill, do you remember? In the home in Madison West 5, you had already been given the last rites. You were suffering, Agnes. I'm not about to forget that.
And Joshua asked me to ease that suffering. Surely you would have wanted that.
Joshua? Of course he'd come.
Of all the children she'd cared for in her years in the home, Joshua Valiente had always been the most remarkable. It was typical of him never to have forgotten, not to have stayed away, to have come back when she needed him most, as her life, after too many decades, guttered like a fading candle. Come back to try to put things right.
Joshua would ask for help. I suppose you weren't about to refuse him.
No, especially as he asked me through gritted teeth. We did rather fall out after the Madison incident.
But he was surely merely asking you to ease my way. I would never have expected this blasphemy.
Now at last the chair swiveled, and Lobsang faced her in an orange robe, his head apparently shaved. She'd seen him in person only once before, and she remembered that face, eerie, not quite the human norm, of no clearly identifiable age, like the reconstructed face of a burns victim, perhaps. She'd remembered her own reflection. Her new mechanical carcass was better quality than this. Evidently, she was a later model. He asked,
"Blasphemy? Must we talk in such terms?"
"Then in what terms do you want to talk?"
"Perhaps about the reason I brought you back."
"Reason? What reason could there possibly be?"
"Oh, a very good one. I would be very pleased if you would rise to this unusual occasion and consider a proposition, a new purpose, which I believe will accord with your own disposition. Will you hear me out?"
Sister Agnes took a seat in an almost identical overstuffed chair opposite him.
"How are you finding your body, by the way?"
She raised her hand, looked at it, flexed her fingers, and imagined she heard the whirring of tiny hydraulic motors.
"I'm finding you've turned me into Frankenstein's monster. Actually, Frankenstein's monster was considerably more learned and worthy than his so-called master. Just a thought." "Get to the point. What do you want?" "Very well. Agnes, knowing a great deal about you from Joshua and from other sources, including your own diaries, and knowing your most excellent sympathy for an irrevocably flawed humanity, I have shanghaied you, so to speak, on behalf of said humanity. I have a mission for you. It is this. I need an adversary."
"A what?"
"Agnes, you know me. You know what I am. I span the world. Indeed, the worlds. I wield an enormous amount of power, starting with the ability to fix parking tickets and working on up to a scale that no tyrant in all of history has been able to boast. I have no master. I report to nobody save myself. Even Douglas Black is only a patron, a facilitator. He could not stop me. And that's what worries me."
"It does?"
"Of course. Shouldn't it? I need an adversary, Agnes. Somebody to tell me when I am out of order, when I'm being inhuman, or being too human, even. It seems to me, given all that Joshua has said about you, that you are uniquely placed to be that person." "You brought me back to life to be your conscience?" "This is ridiculous. Even if I agreed, how could I stop you from doing anything that you want to do?" "I will give you the means to shut me down."
"What? Is that even possible?"
"It's tricky," conceded Lobsang. "There are now a number of iterations of myself scattered across the world, the long Earth, and even various locations around the solar system. You can't have too much backup. But yes, I can find a way to make it happen. To have me deleted from all those places."
"Hmm, and in all those places," said Sister Agnes, "where is your soul?"
"Here, talking to you like this, in these new bodies. Surely we can agree that the soul has no boundaries."
"Do I have a choice in any of this?"
"Of course. You can walk away now, and you will be taken anywhere on the planet that you wish. You will never hear from me again, or, well, you too have an off switch, Agnes. But I know that you are not going to take those options."
"Oh, you do, do you?"
"You see, when I came to visit you with Joshua that day, and I asked you if you had any regrets, do you remember? You whispered, 'So much left to do.' Now you have the chance to do more. What do you say? Will you be Boswell to my Johnson, Agnes? Watson to my Holmes? Satan to my Miltonic God? Your nagging wife?"
He laughed, an eerie, not quite human sound. Sister Agnes was uncharacteristically silent for some time. The loudest noise was the not quite authentic fire. In this womb of a room, she felt stuffy and closed. She longed to be out of here, out on the open road.
"What happened to my Harley?"
"Joshua had it stored properly, off the ground, tires overinflated, fuel drained from the tank, everything greased up."
"Will I be able to ride it? I mean, will I be physically capable?
Of course. And will this wretched alchemy of yours allow me to drink beer?
Most certainly.
Where the hell am I, by the way?
In Sweden, at the headquarters of a wholly owned subsidiary of the Black Corporation's medical division. It's a nice crisp day outside.
Is it?
There are bikes.
I thought ahead, you see. Not Harleys, but...
Would you like to go for a ride?
It was tempting. To be young again. Young and on the road.
In a moment, she said firmly. How's Joshua?
Chapter 27. So Joshua found himself sitting with Sister Agnes reincarnate in a shabby coffee shop in Madison West 5. It was an odd atmosphere. Two people trying to get a grip on this inexplicable new world. A world where the dead could rise and sit cheerfully sipping a coffee while talking of old times. Two people not quite finding the words that needed to be said. As it was, however, for now, the smiles were doing the job. Agnes sat upright, a bit primly, sipping her coffee. Maybe her features were just a little too regular, her skin a little too smooth to be convincingly human. But as far as Joshua was concerned, too many of the regulars in this coffee shop, mostly low-earth construction workers, took a much too irreligious interest in Agnes's new curves.
They ought to have more respect for the Wimple.
Oh, hush. All men are rudimentary creatures who respond to symbols a lot more basic than a habit and a crucifix.
I can't quite believe this is happening.
Neither can I. And it's hard to even believe I'm here to do the disbelieving, if you know what I mean.
When he looked up, she was smiling, that flagstone cracking beam of a smile that had always made her look 20 years younger. Agnes's smile wasn't the kind of smile that the regular world would associate with the word none. It was a smile that had always contained a touch of mischief, and also a terrible rage, kept in check until it was needed. This was what had enabled her to sustain the home and her many other projects in the face of opposition from the Vatican on down, the smile and the rage. She sipped her coffee quite convincingly, just as Lobsang's ambulance units always had. He tried not to think about the internal plumbing that made this possible. Now she lowered her cup and looked on him with pride, it seemed.
Ah, me. And here you are, a full-grown man, a father, a mayor.
Lobsang did this to you.
He did, she said warningly, though he used some careless talk from you as an excuse to do it, young man. We'll have to have a serious chat about that.
How? I mean...
Either I was downloaded from my poor dying brain via some kind of neural scan into a bucket of gel, or I was brought back by Tibetan monks chanting the Book of the Dead over my already interred corpse for 49 days.
Lobsang tried both ways, he says.
Joshua smiled weakly.
That's Lobsang, all right. Always have a backup. I came to your funeral, you know, but he kept the rest from me, I guess. I didn't know about the reincarnation, or the monks. They must have driven the sisters crazy. Does anybody else know you're back? I mean, at the home?
Yeah, I got in touch with the home as soon as I could. I asked for Sister Georgina. She was the least likely to go bananas when she picked up the phone and heard my voice. Or so I thought. I got a note from the Archbishop, if you want to know. The church picks up more secrets than Lobsang himself. But I'm not public knowledge yet. Of course, I'll have to come out, so to speak, sometime, if I'm to assume my place in the world again. At least, thanks to Lobsang, I'm not the first, revenant in silicon and gel, even if he is wrapped in a cloak of mystery. Enough people are aware of his origins. At least my basic existence might be accepted.
What place in the world?
She pursed her lips.
Well, Joshua... As you ought to know, if you ever paid any attention, before my final illness, I was deputy chief executive of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which represents most of America's Catholic sisters. I was actually in the middle of a terrific fight with the Vatican itself, its Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, that's the Inquisition to you. about a book by a sister Hillary in Cleveland.
A book? What about?
The Spiritual Benefits of Female Masturbation. Joshua sprayed coffee. The male heads turned again. Her eyes glittered, as if she was ready for the fight. We've been at war with the Pope and his cardinals since the Second Vatican Council. Just because we think social justice is more important than opposing abortion or same-sex marriage. Just because we reject their patronizing patriarchy, which is why nuns become nuns in the first place, one way or another. Oh, I can't wait to get back into the fray, Joshua. And with this new body, I'm never going to run out of steam, am I? I'll be the Energizer Bunny of militant nuns.
What's an Energizer Bunny?
Oh, my dear child, you have so much to learn.
Tell me why Lovesang brought you back. Not for my benefit, I'm guessing. She snorted.
Maybe that's 10% of it. Apparently, I am to serve as a moral compass for Lobsang himself.
Hmm, that's not necessarily a bad idea.
Maybe so, but I remain astonished that he doesn't realize that the pointer of my own moral compass is severely bent around the stop.
He grinned. I remember when you hit that papal nuncio with a shoe. We all enjoyed that, even though we knew nothing about the scandal that guy was wrapped up in at the time. Then about 2 years afterwards, the cover-up was exposed, and we all wished that you had hit him with both shoes.
Of course, at first, I hated Lobsang for bringing me back from the dead. What a cheek! But at the same time, if you can understand me, I was beside myself with gratitude that he did so.
She looked down at her body, at her hands. But he gave you the choice of not going along with this, right? You could have gone off and led some independent, life, or...
Or have him show me where my off switch is.
How did he convince you?
She looked thoughtful. Well, I'll tell you the truth. It was one particular conversation we had. Lobsang said about something or other, does not compute. Right, I said. That was an ironic allusion, by the way, Lobsang had added. They'd been in a kind of gym, both in more or less incongruous tracksuits, where Lobsang was helping Agnes develop her physical reflexes. What was an ironic allusion?
The phrase, does not compute, was used in an ironic sense, to imply bewildered exasperation, said Lobsang patiently. It was not used unthinkingly as an error message in response to insufficient or contradictory information. Lobsang?
Yes?
What the hell are you talking about?
You persist in thinking of me as a computer. I am trying to dispel that illusion.
Why are you shaking your head?
Sorry. It's just, well, you're trying too hard, I think.
You may call me Lobby. Perhaps pet names will break the ice, do you suppose?
Lobby?
Joshua, he kept pausing, waiting for me to carry on talking. Have you ever spent time with a foreigner who wants to practice his English on you? Lobsang was like that in those first few days, anxiously trying out his humanity on me.
Look, Agnes said, you're going about it all wrong. You're not a human. You can't be a human. You're a very intelligent machine. You're more than human. Can't you live with that? Being human isn't about the brain. It's all tied up with messy things like, well, organs and juices and instincts. You are describing your body, not yourself. In fact, your former body.
Yes, but
externally, you were an animal. But that was not yourself. Externally, I am a machine. But you should not judge by appearances.
Okay, but we could try the Turing test, said Lobsang.
Oh, machines have been able to pass the Turing test for years.
No, the Turing test. We both pray for an hour and see if God can tell the difference.
And she had to laugh. That was it? He made you laugh?
Well, it was the first time he actually seemed authentically human. And he did keep on. It was like being licked to death by puppies. He wore me down in the end.
Joshua nodded. You know, if this works out even 10%, he's going to be lucky to have you.
She snorted.
You'd better ask him that. I'm learning to crack the whip.
Joshua, I know you've had your differences with him.
You can say that again. When I called him in to help you, it was about the only time I've spoken to him since the Madison nuke.
I think he misses you, you know. He spans the world, but he has few friends, if any.
Which is why he has to manufacture them, right?
That's rather harsh, Joshua. On both of us.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Look, Agnes, as far as I'm concerned, however you got here, it's just good to have you back.
Now she looked oddly concerned. She took both his hands in hers, as she used to when he was small, and there was something difficult she needed to tell him.
But you and I know the real question, Joshua.
What question?
I look like Agnes. I think like her. I can carry on her work. I feel like I'm her. But can I be her? I'm a nun, Joshua. Or Agnes was. And enough of a nun to know that there's no place in Catholic theology for Tibetan-style reincarnation.
Then what?
She looked away, which was not characteristic of her.
My death, Joshua.
Yes.
I experienced it. What we call the personal judgment, or something like it. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. I encountered God. Or so it feels, so I believe.
She raised her hands again and turned them over, inspecting them. And now here I am in this miraculous new form. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality.
She twinkled a smile at him. Don't worry, I won't ask you for chapter and verse. Maybe I'm some sort of electronic ghost, not Agnes at all, or at best, a blasphemous mockery of her. Or maybe instead, I'm here to fulfill the will of God in a new way, in a world transformed by technology, to fulfill that will in a way that was never possible before. I feel I'm ready to accept the latter interpretation for now.
He stirred the last of his coffee.
What does Lovesang want, do you think? What's he trying to become? The guardian of the whole human race, maybe?
She thought about that.
I rather believe that he might be more like a gardener.
Which sounds nice and bucolic and harmless, right up to the time you remember that a gardener must sometimes prune.
He stood. I have to go back. My family have had a lot of problems since we got back here.
I heard.
About the nature of your new existence. Well, I did spend a lot of time with Lobsang. I'm no theologian. My advice is, just get on with it. Do the good that's in front of you. That's what you always said.
That's true. Actually, at some point, I'm hoping for a bit of theological guidance from those fellas in fancy dress from the Vatican.
I don't care about the Vatican. As far as I'm concerned, you're my Agnes.
Thank you, Joshua. She stood and hugged him. Don't be a stranger.
Never.
Chapter 28. Sally returned to Monica Jansen's home, arriving without any warning, without any explanation of where she'd been. Jansen had been alone in the house. She had been waiting for Joshua to return from his visit to the home. Helen was off talking to cops and lawyers about bail conditions, and Dan was happily playing softball with Bill Chambers, who was monumentally hungover as ever. They sat over coffees, two oddballs thrown accidentally together, Jansen thought. Sally seemed restless as usual. Her pack was waiting at the door, and she wore the multi-pocketed sleeveless jacket that was the basis of her field gear. They tentatively talked about life and what they had in common, the long earth and Joshua. In an odd way, Joshua had always been at the center of MPD Lieutenant Monica Jansen's experience of the long earth, as it had opened up on her watch and ultimately defined her career path, indeed her whole life. Now she told Sally anecdotes about the old days, like about the repeated attempts she had made to recruit Joshua. There was one time, 7 months after Step Day, when Jensen had arranged to talk to Joshua at the home, then still located in Datum, Madison. The talk had been chaperoned, and that was fair enough, Jensen had thought, sitting on a sofa with a sister or two, as the old song went. After all, Joshua was still just 14 years old, and his suspicion of her had been so solid it was like an extra person crowding on the sofa with Jensen and the sisters. He'd said, "Do you want to study me?" "What?" "Hand me over to the professors at the university. Put me in a cage and study me." She felt shocked. "No, Joshua, never that. Listen, you've become notorious, a legend, whether you like it or not. But right from the start, from step day, I've done my best to keep you off the official record." He thought that over. "Why?" "Because it would be bad for you. You can do as you please. But I want you to think, well, about working with me, not for me. Put your abilities and all that positive energy you have to good use. I can get you assignments, ways to help people. I'm talking about paid work, like a Saturday job. It won't get in the way of your schoolwork. Joshua, I promise that if you work with me, I'll continue to protect you." He flinched. "But if I won't work with you, you won't protect me?" "No, no, Joshua, that came out wrong. Look, I'll protect you come what may." But he had just vanished, a pop of displaced air, gone, leaving the two sisters exasperated. Jensen had looked on the bright side. He hadn't actually said no. She had kept on trying until, grudgingly, he had become an ally. And he had been an ally ever since. "Nice story," Sally said. "And that was really your way of protecting him, right?" "A friend for life, that's Joshua. He does seem to surround himself with strong women. You, Helen, Sister Agnes, and you too, retired Lieutenant Jensen. I'll take that as a compliment. Must be difficult for Helen sometimes, however. She is his wife." Sally looked away. "I'm profoundly uninterested in Helen. A gloomy little stay-at-home. Although she did throw a good right hook at that nut job in immigration." "That she did." Sally kept glancing at her watch. Jensen asked cautiously, "So, where are you going next?" "The Gap." "Really? Because of Mary the Troll, I guess." "Yeah." Jensen smiled. "What will you do? Wave a placard?" "Why not? It's better than letting the poor creature be put to death, out of sight and out of mind." "True enough. It was a shocking incident. When I saw it, I wrote a few mails myself, you know. That was how I got the leverage to have Joshua meet Senator Starling. I wish I could go with you." Sally faced her. "Are you serious?" That took Jensen aback. She'd spoken on impulse. "What? Well, yes, I guess. If I could. Why'd you ask?" "Because you're useful, that's why. You're Joshua Spooky Jensen. You can get things done in the human world where I can't." Sally looked diffident, as if she hated to admit the slightest weakness. "Maybe together we could do some good, or at least scare the spacesuit pants off those dweebs up at the Gap. Joshua said you put things right. That's your strength. Well, because of this whole business with the trolls, there's soon going to be something not right with the whole of the Long Earth. Come with me. What do you say?" Jensen smiled weakly. "What? Just like that? It's kind of Thelma and Louise, isn't it? And at my age and my condition, I'm not supposed to be more than a couple of hours from my hospital. I suppose I could self-medicate, but I've never been nearly that far stepwise. It's 2 million steps to the Gap, right? I don't think I'd make it." "Don't be so hasty." Sally winked. "Remember who you're speaking with. I know a couple of shortcuts." "It's crazy. It's impossible. Isn't it?" Chapter 29. As Jensen and Sally were preparing to leave Madison West 5, Maggie Kaufman was just arriving.
"Find me a troll expert,"
Maggie had told Joe Mackenzie. What the captain wanted, the captain got. It had taken a couple of days. No outer net search was quick, by the nature of its very infrastructure, although the closer you got to the datum, the faster information was swapped around. But Max soon turned up a number of universities that had investigated trolls in the wild. He showed Maggie some of their reports. Trolls were found to be inquisitive, convivial, and quick learners. It was generally agreed that they were at least pre-sapient, but a minority of scholars declared that they were in fact truly sapient, though their intelligence had a different perspective, a different basis from human minds. Clearly they learned at a phenomenal rate. All this seemed a little dry to Maggie. She asked Mac to find somebody who knew trolls better than as test subjects or specimens, somebody who lived with them. Which was why she left her command briefly, and without letting her superiors know, stuffed shirts like Ed Cutler would have squashed this initiative before it had begun, she dashed on a fast commercial train back east, ending up on a world 5 steps west of the datum, at the new city of Madison, Wisconsin. A few miles outside the city, Dr. Christopher Pagel and his wife Juliet, among other activities, ran a rescue center for maltreated big cats, animals bought illegally by drug barons and other slimeballs, and displayed for the machismo, then abandoned when they were no longer cute. The business predated Step Day, when it was set up the victims had included lions and tigers, but since then, thanks to the opportunities opened up for new kinds of trophies through access to the long earth and its kaleidoscope of unspoiled worlds, the roomy cages had also housed such beasts as a saber-toothed smilodon and even a cave lion, Panthera leo atrox. And the Pagels were using an extended family of trolls to help with the business. The Pagels, elderly but elegant and remarkably kindly, told Maggie that the trolls help with more than just heavy labor. Their very presence seemed to calm the cats. Dr. Chris described how the male of the local family of trolls had a very good way of dealing with one potentially troublesome tiger, who after one attempted attack on its keeper, was gripped to the neck by a big troll hand and pushed slowly and carefully to the ground, at a speed and pressure that made it clear to the big cat that ending up underground was just a possibility, if he didn't get with the program. Maggie learned a lot of other details about the trolls from the Pagels, such as what they wanted from humans, it seemed, was entertainment, variety, new concepts. Show even a juvenile troll something like a lawnmower with bolts big enough for troll fingers to work, and he or she would carefully take it apart, keeping all the bits neatly in a line, and then put it back together again, for the sheer joy of it. Juliet Pagel had experimented with human music. A good gospel choir would have trolls sitting in rapturous silence, as would 1960s close harmony groups like the Beach Boys. Maggie's decision about the trolls was slowly solidifying. As far as she was concerned, she had to be mindful of the fact that her command was tasked to be an ever-present symbol of the United States Aegis. As such, it wasn't enough for the Benjamin Franklin to tour these outer worlds like an old-fashioned dreadnought, projecting vague threat and handing out leaflets about how you had to pay your taxes. Her mission had to symbolize the nation's positive values, and that meant, in this age of the long earth, living in harmony with the other inhabitants of the stepwise worlds, in particular with the trolls. Sally Lindsay had been right, she decided on reflection. How better to show that than by having trolls actually aboard her ship? As a train captain, Maggie had been granted a great deal of latitude in her decision-making out here. Still, she spent time trying to make sure she had got the support of at least a majority of her crew for this experiment. And she had no intention of telling her superiors what she was up to, until she absolutely had to. So when she returned to her ship, she brought 3 trolls with her. They were a family, parents with a juvenile. The Pagels had called them Jake, Marjorie, and Carl. As soon as they boarded, despite all Maggie's groundwork in advance, the argument started once more. She let them run. The trolls weren't going anywhere. In the event, it was only a week before the crew of the Franklin, as they drifted through the skies of countless stepwise Americas, became accustomed to stopping work at twilight when the big loading bay doors were flung open and the trolls joined in the harmonies and undertones of the long call as it echoed across the reaches of world after world.
I mean, Maggie said to Mac and Nathan, in Star Trek they put a Klingon on the bridge.
And a Borg, said Nathan.
Well, there you go.
Not a Romulan, though, Mac said. Never a Romulan.
The trolls are staying, Maggie said firmly. Chapter 30. It took Nelson Azikiwe a couple of months after that talk with Ken, when he'd let the cat out of the bag about his resignation, for him to tidy up his affairs in the parish, dispose of extraneous belongings, and brief his successor, including on the temperamental toilet, before he was ready to depart on the next phase of his life, in search of the Lobsang project and other mysteries. He took his time. He had always led something of an itinerant life, but believed in making time to say his goodbyes properly. He decided to travel to America by plane. His generation wasn't used to the slow boat nature of twain travel, but there weren't as many planes around these days, Nelson discovered, not since the Long Earth had begun to be serviced by the twains. It was the New Worlds, of course, for which the twains were so well suited. Airships didn't need airports. They could set you down easily almost anywhere. But even for lateral cross-Earth travel, even on the datum, airships had come back into vogue. For one thing, helium, a safely non-flammable lift gas, was a whole lot easier to obtain now, the datum's natural stock having been badly depleted before the resources of the stepwise worlds had been opened up. And the stately pace of airships certainly worked for cargo. Sacks of corn and mineral ore didn't mind how long it took to get there, and rarely complained about the in-flight movie. But an industry like the traditional airlines would take some time to die, and for now, on the datum, the plane still flew. Even though for this trip, Nelson had to put up with delays, as many US flights were grounded because of ash clouds arising from an event at Yellowstone, some kind of minor eruption there. The plane Nelson finally caught swung out from England, crossed the North Atlantic, flew down over the Canadian Shield, and at last reached the endless farmland of Datum, America, which spread beneath his window like a glowing carpet. If you had the eye for it, he realized, there were occasional gaps to be seen in that grand panorama of cultivation, scraps of recovering wildness in the summer green where a homestead or a farm had been abandoned, almost certainly because the owners had decided to step westward. And it was west for most Americans, despite the assurances of the experts that the stepping labels west and east were purely arbitrary. Off they stepped, in search of more land, a better life. Or, he mused, possibly they went simply because, well, the new worlds were out there, and there was something in the genes of an American, and perhaps even a Canadian, that impelled you always to move on. It was a frontier with apparently no end, and while there wasn't exactly a stepwise stampede these days, the Long Earth still drew in the pioneers. His own destination was more modest, O'Hare. He'd stop in Chicago a while. Then he had plans to visit a new university being built in Madison, Wisconsin, West 5, as part of the city's post-nuke recovery. He had friends there and interests. Madison was where Willis Lindsay had first posted the plans for a prototype stepper box on the internet, a glorious destructive gesture that had changed the world forever, indeed the worlds. And Madison had been the boyhood home of Joshua Valiente himself. Nelson, on the track of the Lobsang project, had an inkling that Madison was a place where he might find some things out, get some questions answered. As it turned out, this tentative plan didn't even survive his leaving the airport. Nelson was always glad to get out of the cramped enclosure of a plane. He was a large man, the kind of man who had trouble fitting into an airline seat, but who could walk through any neighborhood anywhere without having to worry over much about his security. Sometimes the deference accorded to him simply because of his size bothered him. But by and large, he reflected as he patiently queued his way through the landing process, he had to admit it was useful to get your way without even asking.
His size had certainly saved him from all but a few scuffles in the South African townships of his boyhood. All such troubles had, however, evaporated when he found the local library and discovered a universe of ideas into which his young consciousness rose faster than a Saturn V into the Florida sky. That wasn't to say he had simply soaked up the lessons of authority. Almost from the beginning, he was identifying problems to solve, and indeed solving them. One teacher remarked that he had a genius for connectivity. His life had changed utterly for better or worse the day he had first applied his analytical skills to the concept of the Almighty. Even if you dismiss the traditional notion of God, it had always seemed to him that without a first cause of some kind, there was a philosophical void, a space to let. His buddies in the nerdosphere populated that void with the Illuminati, maybe, or the staring eye in the dollar bill triangle. After step day, after the opening up of a universe vast, fecund, and accessible to mankind, it seemed to him that the need to fill that void had only deepened, which was essentially why he had decided to devote the next phase of his life to an exploration of that void and related mysteries. Anyhow, this morning at O'Hare, Nelson's intimidating size, backed up by his problem-solving ability, certainly helped him thread his way through the maze of US immigration. And at the final customs barrier, after Nelson had cleared through, a clerk chased him and produced a leaflet.
"Oh, this was left for you, Mr. Azikiwe."
The leaflet was an ad for a Winnebago. Nelson was planning to fly to Madison. He didn't need a Winnebago. But when he looked up again, the clerk was gone. Nelson felt a thrill of connectivity, like solving a quizmaster's puzzle.
"I get it, Lobsang," he said, and he pocketed the leaflet.
By an hour later, he had rented a top-of-the-line Winnebago, with plenty of generator capacity for his tech, and a bed, a big one, just the size for him. He drove out of the airport parking area in this home on wheels, and having no further instructions he could discern, picked a direction at random and hit the freeway. Just the experience of driving on such roads was glorious. He wondered if this, in the end, was the ultimate expression of the American dream, to be in transit, all problems left behind like discarded trash, nothing in life but follow the horizon movement, motion for the sake of it. He drove west for the rest of the morning. Then he parked up in a small town, shopped for fresh food, and logged on for a quick inspection of the latest sweepings of the online world, including the findings of his buddies and the quizmasters. He'd had them working 24/7 on his problem since he'd tantalized them with the barest hint.
"Say, we have all seen that clip of the Mark Twain being towed into Madison and the girl talking about a cat that spoke Tibetan, haven't we? Is there a clue there? But a clue about what? Looks like someone is playing with our heads."
Given Nelson's starting hint, the quizmasters had been going crazy, speculating, inferring, and pattern matching. Standing in the Winnebago, making an elegant curry from fresh-bought ingredients, Nelson watched messages and tangled hypotheses flicker across his screens and thought it all over. When the curry was ready, he largely ignored the screens. Nelson had learned to love the manners of the English past, as he'd known them in St. John on the Water, when people used to address their food. There was something about the phraseology that made the boy from the townships smile. But while he ate, he saw from the corner of his eye how the quizmasters were beating themselves up, putting out theories at the rate of one a minute, some of them completely outlandish. And then up came one trace that drew his attention. Thanks to an oddity of TV scheduling, by hopping among various channels, starting just about now, it would be possible to watch the classic movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind continuously for the next 24 hours. He murmured,
"So, Devil's Tower, Lobsang. It's been done before, a bit unoriginal, but I've never been there. I've always wanted to see it. I won't ask how to find you. I rather believe you will find me."
Nelson finished his curry and cleaned up. His sat-nav told him it was around 1,000 miles northwest from Chicago to Wyoming. A dream ride in a vehicle like this. He'd take his time, he decided, and see the sights. He was nobody's puppet. Maybe he'd even catch one of those iterations of Close Encounters. Chapter 31. Their final fall through the soft places, the longest of all, brought Sally and Jansen to a world only a dozen steps or so from the gap itself. Soft places transported you geographically as well as stepwise. They landed in England, the northwest, near the Irish Sea coast, a location Sally knew was close to the footprint of Gap Space, home of the new space cadets. Monica Jansen arrived exhausted, bewildered. Sally had to help her lie down on the soft grass of this latest hillside, wrapped in a cocoon of silvery emergency blankets. It had taken a week for them to traverse the 2 million worlds to the gap through the soft places. A lot faster than any twain, but a grueling journey even so. Sally had to scry out the soft places, using motions like a kind of Tai Chi. They seemed to cluster in the continental heartlands, away from the coasts. They were easier to find at dawn or sunset. Sometimes Jansen could even see them, a kind of shimmer. Weird stuff. But they would take you wherever you wanted to go in 4 or 5 steps. Jansen, for her part, had never complained as they travelled, and it had taken a few transitions for Sally to work out just how hard it was for her. A soft place was a flaw in the long Earth's quasi-linear pan-dimensional geometry. Finding soft places was the unique skill Sally's genetic inheritance had given her, and it was a hell of a lot easier than plodding all the way out, step by step, the way that dull little mouse Helen Valiente had once walked through 100,000 worlds with her family to set up their pioneer-type log cabin. But nothing came for free, and the soft places did take something out of you. It wasn't an instantaneous transition, like a regular step. There was a sense of falling, of deep sucking cold, of a passage that lasted a finite time. That was how you remembered it, even if your watch showed that no time had passed at all. It was grueling, energy-sapping. Plus, Jansen was already ill, even before they set off. But Jansen wasn't the type who would complain, whatever you did. Sally bustled around, collecting wood for a fire, unpacking their food and drink. Then, in this late afternoon, a warm enough late May day in this particular stepwise England, she sat quietly beside her fire, letting Jansen sleep off the journey. And Sally watched the moon rise. It wasn't the moon she was used to. In this world, only a few steps from the gap itself, Luna was liberally spattered with recent craters. The Mare Imbrium, the man in the moon's right eye, was almost obliterated, and Copernicus was outdone by a massive new scar, a brilliant splash whose rays stretched across half the visible disk. It must have been something to see, she thought, on this world and its neighbours, when Belos and its stepwise brothers had made their shuddering close approach, missing this particular Earth but passing nearby, and the ground below would have convulsed from bombardment by random fragments, while the face of the moon above lit up like a battlefield in the sky. Jansen stirred now and sat up. Sally had set a pot of coffee on the little stand over the fire. Jansen took a tin mug gratefully in gloved hands and looked up at the sky in a vague way. "What's wrong with the moon?" "We're too close to the gap, is what's wrong with it." Jansen nodded, sipping the coffee. "Listen, before we get there, just imagine I'm a dumb cop who knows more about bloodstains and drunks than about cosmology and spaceships. What exactly is the gap? And what's it got to do with space cadets?" "The gap is a hole in the long Earth. Look, the alternate Earths go on forever, as far as we know, all broadly similar, though differing in detail, but the gap is the only place so far found where the Earth is missing altogether. If you were to step over, you'd find yourself floating in vacuum. There was an impact, a big rock, maybe an asteroid or comet or something like a rogue moon, came calling. The space cadets call this hypothetical object Belos." "Why Belos?" Sally shrugged. "Some dumb old movie reference, I think. Joshua might know.
and Lobsang's probably got the movie. Everything that can happen must happen somewhere, right? Velos, or copies of it, came swimming out of the dark and completely missed uncounted billions of Earths. A few, like this one, were close enough to its path to be sideswiped by fragments and suffered varying amounts of damage. Like what? Like splattering new craters over the moon? Like stripping away lots of atmosphere from the Earth? Or changing the pole positions? Or messing with continental shift, generally making the extinction of the dinosaurs look like a street fight, but not wiping out the planet altogether? Jensen nodded.
I can see where the story is going. And one Earth was taken out entirely.
Jensen whistled. The idea seemed to frighten her.
It could have hit us, she said.
Datum Earth was way up the other end of the probability curve.
Yes, but if it hadn't been,
even if we'd been living on one of these nearby worlds, earthquakes, tidal waves, that kind of fun. Oh, the dust winter would probably have killed us off, us or our primate ancestors, more likely. It was that long ago.
Nasty.
No, it's just statistics. It happened, that's all. Sally poured more coffee. It couldn't happen now, at least. Not that way. The extinction of mankind, I mean. We've spread out. The Long Earth is an insurance policy. Even a Belos couldn't take out all of us.
Okay, and this gap is useful because?
Because you can step into space. You see, on World Gap minus one, you put on a spacesuit, step over, and there you are, gently orbiting the sun. No need to ride a rocket the size of a skyscraper to fight Earth's gravity, because there ain't no Earth there. And once you're out there, you can go anywhere. That's the dream, anyhow. Access to space.
Jensen's head was drooping. Can't wait to see it. In the morning, yes?
In the morning. You sleep. I'll put the tent up before it gets dark.
Are you hungry?
No, thanks. And I took my meds.
She lay down again, pulling the blankets over her.
Good night, then.
Good night, Sally.
As Jensen slipped back into sleep, Sally sat silently, perhaps the only awake, sapient mind on this planet. And as the light dimmed and the battered moon brightened, she felt as if someone had knocked out the walls of her mind. The landscape, a grassy hillside stretching away before her, seemed to acquire depth, otherness, in a direction she could almost see. It was bottomless, multidimensional, endless. She had once dreamed that she had found out how to fly. It was absurdly easy. All you had to do was jump into the air and jump again when you were up there. Now she chased the tantalizing feeling that all she needed was the trick of it, and she could step away, not into one world at a time, but spread across the Long Earth. A whole thick band of worlds, all at once. The very air around her felt prickly, the land as insubstantial as smoke. But then Jensen coughed and moaned softly in her sleep. Sally's infinity high evaporated, as quickly as it had come. Chapter 32 Slowly, the crew of the Franklin got used to their troll crewmates. That didn't apply to all the colonies they visited, though. New Melfield was a grubby and unprepossessing farming community in the Corn Belt. The whole township turned out when the Franklin descended, and seemed uniformly astonished when a family of trolls followed the human crew down the lowered gangway. The trolls and the rest strolled around, while Maggie chatted to the local mayor, passed over datum documentation, and generally engaged the man and put him at his ease. Indeed, he evidently needed his ease putting at, for her briefing had pegged this place as yet another nasty little locus of spite towards trolls, not to mention humans and other dumb animals. Well, change had to start by degrees. So by mid-morning, this mayor had three trolls in his office, actually sitting on chairs. Trolls just loved chairs, especially if they swiveled. And when Maggie had finished the coffee she'd been offered, she said clearly,
"Wash up, please, Carl."
The young troll, holding the mug like an heirloom, looked around the room, spotted the open door to the little coffee station and sink area in the room next door, carefully washed the mug in the sink, and placed it just as carefully in a rack. Then he walked back to Maggie, who gave him a peppermint.